This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we revisit Fukushima. We'll hear from Yasuteru Yamada, a Japanese retiree who is helping clean up the scene of the nuclear crime. Also, Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates with an overview of the situation at Fukushima. This is 5 o'clock shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. September 19th represents the first anniversary of one of the largest ever nuclear protests in post-Fukushima Japan. The event, called Sayonara Genpatsu, or Goodbye Nuclear Power Plants, addressed radioactive contamination and the ongoing health, environmental, economic, and criminal consequences of the March 11th, 2011 multiple meltdowns and continuing disaster at four reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi Atomic Complex on the Pacific shore of central Japan. In today's shadow, we revisit Fukushima by way of a first-hand report from Yasuteru Yamada, co-founder of the Skilled Veterans Corps for Fukushima. But we begin with a situational overview from nuclear engineer and plant operator Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates.
On the morning of March 11th, 2011, a Richter 9 earthquake out in the Pacific Ocean, about 100 miles off the coast of Japan, caused a shockwave that hit the island. The nuclear plants on the island shut down quickly, and there's inconclusive evidence about whether they really did survive that earthquake or not. But about 45 minutes later, a huge tsunami hit the island and wiped out those nuclear power plants. This is not just Fukushima Daiichi. The wave hit Fukushima Daiichi, Fukushima Daini, Anagawa, and Tokai, and all of them were damaged by the same tsunami. About a week after the accident, I was on CNN, and I told John King that it wasn't about the earthquake, and it wasn't about the tsunami wiping out the diesels that knocked out the Fukushima Daiichi reactors. We brought up a satellite video that showed the damage to the pumps along the ocean. It's just rubble. Now, these pumps were relatively strong. They were designed to withstand earthquakes and anything Mother Nature could throw at them. The space along the coast is just a scrapyard of twisted metal. You know, in your car, you have a pump on the front of the engine called a water pump. If the water pump fails, your engine dies. Well, that's really what happened at Fukushima Daiichi. Those pumps along the water provide cooling water to the diesels, just like the pump on the front of your engine on your car. And without those pumps operating, the diesels were doomed to fail anyway. It doesn't matter if those diesels were 100 feet in the air. The pumps along the water were destroyed. And that is the real root cause of the accident at Fukushima Daiichi. We call that the loss of the ultimate heat sink. And the key word there is ultimate. You need the ocean to pull the water out of the nuclear reactor to keep it cool. But that same water has to cool the diesels to make that happen. The diesels would not have worked even if they hadn't been flooded. Now, this problem that we call the loss of the ultimate heat sink didn't just happen at Fukushima Daiichi 1, 2, 3, and 4. All six reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi site experienced it, but also at the Fukushima Daini site, the Anagawa site, and the Tokai site. Between those four sites, there was 14 nuclear reactors. They had 37 diesels. Nine of them failed because of the tsunami. Those are the ones at Fukushima Daiichi 1, 2, 3, and 4. But 15 others failed too. Mainstream media isn't talking about that. The nuclear industry is not talking about that either. The diesels were not flooded. What happened was the pumps along the ocean were destroyed, not just for Fukushima Daiichi 1, 2, 3, 4, but for at every one of those sites at least one diesel was knocked out because it couldn't be cooled. On December 21st, 2011, a report was written by a Team H2O project. And it discussed what are the lessons that we really should learn from the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear accident. It's a long report, 250 pages, and we have it on the website. But the key page, as far as I'm concerned, is page 108. There's a really complicated graph on the page, but let me explain it. The pink boxes on that graph are the diesels that were destroyed from flooding. And you'll see the diesels at Fukushima Daiichi were destroyed from flooding, but also one at Fukushima Daini was also destroyed by the flood. More importantly, there are 15 other boxes on that chart that are orange. Those represent the 15 diesels that didn't work, not because they were flooded, but because the cooling water systems had been destroyed by the tsunami. So the 9 that failed because they were flooded would have failed anyway because their pumps were destroyed, plus 15 others were destroyed just because they couldn't be cooled. Between the 4 sites, Fukushima Daiichi, Daini, Anagawa, and Tokai, there were 37 diesels. 24 were wiped out by the tsunami. There's an important lesson here, and the lesson is that it doesn't matter where we put the diesels. We have to put the cooling pumps at the water because that's where the water is. The nuclear industry isn't addressing that. They're focusing on moving the diesels or hardening the diesels or protecting the diesels from flooding. But in fact, the key that has to be resolved here is what are you going to do to protect the pumps along the edge of the water? Now there's another piece to this puzzle that the mainstream media and the nuclear industry don't want to talk about. It's the fact that this accident occurred when everyone was already on the site. There were 1,000 people working at Fukushima Daiichi and another 1,000 people working at Fukushima Daini. Had the earthquake and the ensuing tsunami occurred 12 hours later, there would have been 100 people working at Fukushima Daiichi and another 100 at Daini, about 6 miles away. The roads would have been destroyed, either by the tsunami or the earthquake, and the people could not have returned to work. It was through Herculean efforts by 1,000 heroes at both of those sites that rescued the world from a more serious accident than the one we have already experienced. Think about how bad it would have been if the accident had been in the evening. We would have had 10 nuclear reactors in meltdown, and likely other problems at the Anagawa plant and the Tokai plant. So when we talk about the Fukushima Daiichi accident, I think one, it should be called accidents, because we had 3 nuclear reactors explode and another fuel pool in jeopardy. But also, it wasn't just Fukushima Daiichi. Fukushima Daini was in jeopardy for days. Anagawa was in trouble for more than a day. And Tokai also experienced trouble. So there were 14 nuclear reactors in jeopardy on March 11th. And the world instead was focused on Fukushima Daiichi. There's a citizen scientist in Pennsylvania who has suggested, and I think it's a great suggestion, that we add a level to the international nuclear scale to address the fact that when more than one nuclear plant is having an accident, the whole world needs to mobilize to solve the problem. I'm sure you know that Fukushima Daiichi and Chernobyl were both considered level 7 accidents, which is the worst that could happen. Adding a level to the international scale on nuclear accidents and adding its level 8 accident is not about the amount of radiation released. I think Fukushima Daiichi released somewhat more radiation than Chernobyl, but even if they're roughly the same, that's not the point. The point is that it was a multi-unit accident, and it also affected many sites. Well, that affects how many resources are brought in from outside. And that's why Scott Porcelain's recommendation that we add a level to the nuclear accident scale is so important. So Mr. Porcelain is recommending, and I agree with him, that we really need one more rung on the international emergency scale. We need a level 8. It's not about how much radiation was released. It's about when multiple sites or multiple units are involved, the accident can be much, much worse than what we encountered. In fact, as I've said, if 12-hour difference in this accident would have very likely meant the destruction of Japan, because 2,000 people happened to be there, they were able to rescue plants that were in dire straits. The two lessons for today are, one, the nuclear industry needs to move the pumps or protect the pumps with something called submersible pumps so that they work even when they're flooded. And the second piece is that the International Atomic Energy Agency needs to admit that there's circumstances beyond a level 7, a level 8, where international cooperation is critical.
Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates is a frequent visitor to Japan, where his new book, Fukushima, The Truth and the Future, has achieved bestseller status. Further information is available at fairwinds.com. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And next, we hear an on-scene report about the Fukushima containment effort from Japanese first responder Yasuteru Yamada. Yamada is a co-founder of the Skilled Veterans Corps for Fukushima. That's a group of Japanese retirees who have volunteered to do cleanup work to spare younger people exposure to radiation. Yamada spoke recently about the cleanup and TEPCO's ongoing obstruction of comprehensive solutions to the world's worst nuclear power plant disaster.
Thank you very much, all of you, coming here to hear my speech. I'd like to introduce our Skilled Veteran Corps for Fukushima. But before going to that, I would like to talk what is the Fukushima Daiichi now. Today I'd like to speak entitled Facts and Tasks at Fukushima Daiichi. The reason why I'm talking facts is that there are so many topics, information you have. You are overloaded with the information, and you may not know what is the base, what is more important issue, which covers all of the individual facts. But we have to get the overall viewpoint. Now this is Unit 4. You have heard that about the dangers of the spent fuel pool in Unit 4 very recently. But you see the some 10 people are working on the top floor, and they, at this moment, in this photograph, you see that damaged crane is being removed, meaning that this building is rather clean. Of course, it is contaminated, but man can work in the building, and therefore that building has been reinforced already. And even having the huge amount of spent fuel and not used fuel, new fuels are there in the pool, it is already reinforced. In comparison to this, this is Unit 3, that is much more contaminated, and now, up to now, no one can enter in the building. On the top part of this building has been already almost removed from the outside, but inside is very much contaminated. And it too is the most contaminated. It's count almost 17 sievert per hour. You know that if you get a 7 sievert, you will die immediately. It means that within a half hour, you will die. That is the contamination of unit 2. And unit 1 is a little bit better, but it's still 10 sievert, not millisievert or microsievert. That's a fact. And also unit 1, 2, 3, there are a lot of spent fuel. The number is much less than unit 4, but still very much enough to make crisis if they were damaged. And this is so-called seawall. You see, this is just a pile of stone. And I've asked to the ministry whether this seawall is okay or not. Then he said that the TEPCO is Tokyo Electric Power Company, you know, TEPCO estimated that this seawall is strong enough according to their estimation. But no one can agree to that. This is just a makeshift temporary facility. They have no plan to install permanent concrete seawall yet. Next, you see this is hose conducting the contaminated water to cool the vessels, unit 1, 2, and 3. And such a hose system is not allowed as a permanent facility in the production plant or any plant. And this is also still the makeshift, but there is no plan to replace with the steel pipe. They say that the site is very much contaminated with the radiation material, therefore they are not able to install the bases and structures for the steel pipe. But if you see this such pipe horses, if you had the trouble here, you cannot find which valve you should close. It is a serious problem. That's the reason why the hoses are not allowed to use in the permanent plant. You can find hoses just at the firefighting site, nothing more. And this hose runs from here and then the cleanup, removing the cesium 137 or 134, and then stored, and then transported to this way and recycled to the furnace. The total length of this hose is, say, 2.5 miles. It's an incredible length. Now I'm talking about the reactor vessel. Reactor pressure vessel is the formal name, say, RPV. The right side you see is the RPV at Three Mile Island. You see that the fuel was damaged, or molten, but still remained in the reactor. But in case of Fukushima, the molten fuel breaks the RPV and fell down to the PVC. PVC is the primary containment vessel, we call, and eroded the cement concrete at the bottom. And TEPCO has estimated the depth of the erosion, say 25 inches. But and some concrete still remains until the bottom shell. But there are so huge, big errors contained in the base of calculation, estimation. One is the temperature measured in the vessel, which has certain error because of the accident or explosion. And also, no one knows the shape of the debris, so-called fuel debris. And therefore, there are so many estimation or and in addition to that, the material of the concrete is not uniform. You have to have the mixture of the sand, stone, sand, and concrete. Therefore, uniform erosion cannot be expected. It means that the bottom of the shell of PCV could be damaged. That is not, that cannot be detected or checked, because though this shell is covered by cement concrete and supported by cement concrete, no one can enter in that. But this is very important. I will talk later. Now, the first work we should carry out is to remove the spent fuel from the spent pool. As you know, there are 1535 spent fuel in Unit 4 and say less than 1,000 spent fuel in other units. And the first the work will be done, carried out at Unit 4 because it's not so much contaminated. But anyway, we have to make the pool, the space in the pool, to take out the fuel debris from the vessel, from the PCV. At this moment, there is no pool, no space. That is the reason why we have to take out the, remove the spent fuel from the pool. And this is the so-called cask, which had weight of the 100 tons, or £200. And loaded on the huge truck on the ground and exported to the storage yard. But the crane is essential to hang the 100 tons cask. But as you have seen, there is no building which can walk such for such a heavy duty. Therefore, we have to install the very strong structure at the first. Now, at the Unit 4, this work is being carried out. Just a basement has been done already, and within 2 years, the doors fuel will be removed. But we have to wait for 2 years, and building is something damaged in Unit 1 to 3, and seawall is like that, and hose is so temporary one. And this is a very serious issue. And now I'm talking about the removal of the fuel debris. We have to fill up the vessel, PCV, with the water, because the water is the best sealing material for the radiation. And therefore, it is very essential to fill the vessel. But if there were any damage or at the shell, at the bottom, we cannot fill the vessel by the water, with the water. And as you have seen, this part is cement concrete, and this part is also cement concrete. Therefore, it is very hard to repair this part. And also, there are so many hundreds or thousands of the pipes across the shell, because there are temperature measurement, gas introduction, steam take out, and water inlet, and so on and so. And inside of this vessel is almost full of the pipes and valves. It's very hard to work inside and outside. And also, inside and outside must be seriously contaminated with radioactive materials, and no one knows how we can work that. But anyway, we have to work. And it means that we have to have this serious radiation exposure. And a lot of works can be done by robot, which will be developed within, say, 10 years or 5 years, 10 years. But the last work shall be done by man. Therefore, TEPCO draws the people, person. It is very essential. Robot cannot be 100% as human being. That is the very important issue. Now, I'm talking about exposure doses, annual doses, in 3 Mile Island. Three Mile Island has the accident in 1979, and the cleanup finished within 1789, 10 years, within 10 years. But the fuel debris removal was taken out during the last 5 years. And you can see the exposure is very high during the fuel debris. You can imagine, as I explained, also in the Fukushima, that at the time of the debris removal, we have to have the serious exposure, radiation exposure. No one can avoid that. Of course, we have to make the most effort to reduce the exposure, but finally, we have to have. We can never escape from that damage or problem. Oh, sorry, go back. One point, the TEPCO has estimated the workers' requirement for 5 years. Then they say that last year they had the worker like this level, but in the future they don't need more workers. But in case of the Fukushima Daiichi, the fuel removal will be started after 10 years. And this 5 years means this period. Therefore, in the future, we should have the huge number of the workers. Otherwise, we will not be complete our job. This is the Fukushima. Now, I'm talking about our organization, SVCF. We appeal skilled veterans and PRO to work at Fukushima Daiichi to reduce the radiation exposures, doses for young workers. That is our very simple and clear appeal. And I believe that this is very reasonable and rational, and no one can complain or make other opinion, because that the elder people has much less risk than younger people. Everyone knows that. The reason, there are some three reasons, but it is not necessary, maybe not necessary to explain detail. But anyway, the elder people has less, much less life length remain, and we can walk at such a dangerous area. And we appealed this request in April, started April last year. And within 1 month or 1.5 months, we had a meeting with TEPCO and government, Mr. Hosono. And they said that they welcome us, but at that time, they said nothing more. And in July, we have dispatched our delegation to the site and inspect the site. I was a member of them, and I entered to the Unit 4, as you have seen at the first. And at that time, we have expected that within some months or within last year, we will be able to work at the site together with younger workers. But after that, there was no reply actually from TEPCO, from government, and therefore we have asked them and had a meeting several times. But finally, TEPCO said that we have no room to accept you. And then government said that you are welcome, but if TEPCO accepts, so there's nothing to do. And TEPCO doesn't say why, but anyway, they don't have. And also, we went to the subsidiary company, TEPCO, who are working for TEPCO in several portions. Then they said also that even the TEPCO subsidiary company doesn't have the work ordered from TEPCO. The reason why is that those subsidiary companies are prepared to operate the power plant, but not to repair or to work out for the cleanup. Therefore, they don't have the chance to get the order from the TEPCO. But what is the matter? And we have discussed and studied a lot, and we have come to conclusion. There are so many reasons why, but this is the most important issue, which is the obstacles of our appeal requirement. Now TEPCO is there. TEPCO is now working or dealing with the Fukushima Daiichi at the site. And some workers or employees of TEPCO is working there. And TEPCO orders the job to some prime contractors. But those prime contractors are dividing their order to some tens and subcontract to others. And then subcontract, so on and so on. There are 7-8 layers from top to bottom. And just yesterday, there was some report in the Mainz newspaper that at the bottom, the one company dispatched the worker to their company, and that company dispatched to the other. It means that such a very low-level companies, some companies may work by themselves, some companies just send a name to upper company, nothing more. And TEPCO has contracts with the prime contractors, but no contract with subcontractors. Therefore, TEPCO cannot instruct the subcontractors directly. Therefore, and in addition to that, there are some tens of the employees of TEPCO is working at the site, not more. But in total, there are 3,000, almost 3,000, there are over 3,000 workers at the site every day. And there are 400 contractors, actually. This is formally reported by TEPCO. It's not my estimation. TEPCO's figure means, as the average, less than 10 workers per company. So how TEPCO can accept us? They have only some 10, say 50, 40 companies, people just under the TEPCO's control. This is the, I believe, this is the biggest problem. But simultaneously, this is very traditional system in Japan, in the heavy industries like steel manufacturer, as I work, and other manufacturers, construction works, and so on. Therefore, TEPCO by themselves cannot break such a structure. This structure must be very much strange for you, American people or European people, but in Japan it's very, very common or traditional. And therefore, TEPCO cannot break the structure by themselves. And sometimes, Yakuza, so-called mafia, is working inside. Now, therefore, we have, or we are proposing that this site, Fukushima Daiichi site, should be national project. Presently, it's a part of TEPCO's division, but it should be national project, independent from TEPCO. Because I explain a little bit detail one by one, but now I'm talking the four main points. And employee worldwide expertise means that we have to employ the experience from Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. And integrated project management, essential. As already you know, we have the multi-layered subcontract system. It cannot, it enables to adapt the project management. Integrated management is impossible. And also international inspection team. This is quite new, but the working only in Japan, it's sometimes people are very conservative in Japan, and also Fukushima Daiichi is not a matter, not a trouble only in for Japanese, but also for California people or United States people or worldwide problem. Therefore, I strongly propose to form the international inspection team. Now I talk some detail. Firstly, the team, national project team, should be independent from TEPCO. The reason why is that there are so many issues and unknown. As I talked, the inside of the buildings are very highly contaminated, and no one has been inside yet. And no one knows what happened or what is there. And Therefore, the such project, unknown or uncertain project, cannot be the subject of the profit-oriented company, private company. That should be the national. This is most important, I believe. And under the control of the TEPCO, TEPCO is the power generation and power delivery company, and that company has their own interest for their business, and therefore so many issues, items are covered or not disclosed by such a company, by their own intention. Therefore, we have to have the international neutral organization. Second, I project team shall employ the capabilities, knowledge, experiences from all over the world. That is very, I believe, very clear, not necessary to explain more. And integrated project management. This is very essential, I believe, especially for the exposure dose control. We have to have to cover all of the employees, workers at the site, and who is where, and who does what, and for example, if you refer to our proposal, our people had the age and less power, of course, fiscal power. We don't have as young as, but we are able to be at a rather dangerous area. That the allocation of the 3,000 people at the most optimum place, workplace, should be done by such an integrated project management. That is quite essential for the workers and for the future of this project. I mean, this project takes not only 10 years as like Three Mile Island. It takes, expected to take 40 to 50 years. It is one man's full lifetime or working lifetime. It means that we have to very carefully control the radiation exposure. Otherwise, we have in Japan 50 units. 4 units in the Fukushima Daiichi has been discarded already. Therefore, we have 50 more. But even if the 50 the units wouldn't be operated, but we have to clean up those 50s within some 10 years. Therefore, we have to have the control of the workers at the site very carefully, employing our elder people. That is our strong proposal. And inspection team, this must be very clear, I believe. You may know Japanese people are rather conservative and or not having, generally speaking, their Japanese people are very honest to their given task, but not very active or strong to see the with wide viewpoint. Therefore, I would ask the people from United States or Europe to see the fact as it is. And also, in general, the people who is working at the site is very much concentrated to the given task. It's quite normal. Therefore, the person who are very, very much independent from the actual work should be there, and from several viewpoints. I would like to have the international members to supervise, or not supervise, but inspect the activities. Those four are our request or proposal. Now I'm talking or asking you the reason why I'm talking such in the United States. In Japan, we have proposed some of those 4 points already in August last year, but government doesn't hear nothing. But it means, in general, Japanese government is very insensitive to Japanese people, but very sensitive to United States, unfortunately. And I would ask you to spread our SVCS 4 points all over the United States or further in Europe, and ask your government to work to make the pressure to Japanese government. This is our request to you, and it may not work at once, but as I said, this project takes time, 40, 50 years. Therefore, it's not necessary to be early, quick, but taking the time, we want to spread and make the pressure to the Japanese government. But as I explained today, if that Unit 4 is damaged, it's serious, but the probability to have the damage in Unit 4 is much less than Unit 1, 2, 3. Therefore, I'd like to emphasize to not see only the single unit, single aspect or a single issue. We have to have the total system. That TEPCO is, what can I say? TEPCO is working as they like, or that makes them easier. They are not taking the most required the way, but most easiest way for them. That's my point. Thank you very much for hearing. Thank you very much for inviting us.
Yasuteru Yamada. Yamada is a co-founder of the Skilled Veterans Corps for Fukushima, speaking recently to the Chicago Area Peace Action at the Unitarian Church of Evanston, Illinois, recorded by our Pacifica colleague, Dale Lehman.
20 years back, out at Yucca Flats, our trucks were winding down to the testing site. They had a bomb out there, I still see it clear. It turned night to day, day to endless night. 1,100 soldiers, easy duty combat pay, trucked down to watch that fireball, I still see it clear as day. But it wasn't what they showed us, it was what they didn't say. And if I knew what I was getting into, nothing could have dragged me down to pay the price I've got to pay today. Oh, they told me it was safe, and they swore that it was true. They said the risks are all acceptable. Acceptable to who? They can't cover up the truth no more. I feel it in my bones. You can fool yourself with numbers, but you pay the price alone. till they marched us down, sat us on the ground. And I think they knew what they never said out loud. Our only shelter there was the desert air. With our hands on our faces, our backs to the deadly cloud. Then the world went white, I swear I saw the bones in both my hands. The ground was glowing cherry red so hot we could not stand. And something deep inside me knew just what the army planned. Cause that deadly time bomb started clicking. Deep within my bones it's ticking. You hear that sound, you're quick to understand. But they told me it was safe, and they swore that it was true. They said risks are all acceptable, acceptable to hold. They can't cover up the truth no more. I feel it in my bones. You can fool yourself with numbers, but you pay the price alone. Twenty years passed, this year's my last, and I still can't quite believe just what they did. 20 years passed slow, and all I got to show is a lousy pension for my widow and my kids. So I thought you would hear this warning from one who's been hit hard about their testing sites and their power plants with defenses and their guards. Cause that time bomb, it's a ticking still, and it's right in your backyard. And if you knew what you was getting in, what it finally all comes down to, maybe you'll believe it when I'm dead. Oh, they'll tell you that it's safe, and they'll swear to you it's true. They'll say the risks are all acceptable, 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 acceptable to hold. They can't cover up the truth when it is burning in your bones. They can fool you with their numbers, but you'll pay the price alone.
And that concludes today's edition of 5 O'Clock Shadow, produced with Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins and Reggie Johnson. We welcome your comments, suggestions, leaks, and queries with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.